You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the course of her career, Barbara Kingsolver has looked at social and political issues like racism and colonialism in her novels, and her latest flight behavior takes on one that seems especially timely in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, climate change. It's set in rural Tennessee, where inexplicable changes are taking place, affecting the lives of local farmers. Flight Behavior is published by Harper. I'm very pleased it has brought Barbara Kingsolver back to our show. Hello.
Hi.
Now, you grew up in Kentucky, and since 2004, you lived in southwestern Virginia. So are you writing about an area you know well here?
Yes, I am. This novel is really close to home for me.
Although most of my memory of you, because you've been on the show a number of times, was as someone who was in Arizona. Could this have taken place in Arizona?
This exact plot, no. It couldn't have. You're right. I lived for almost 25 years in Tucson, Arizona. I have been back full-time in southern Appalachia since 04. So it's true that this is probably good evidence that I've settled back into home psychically.
And this is it. Why did you return?
Why did I return in the novel or
in real life?
In real life, it's where I came from. It's to be close to family.
Why did you want to focus on the issue of climate change? Is that, do you start off with a theme?
I do begin by thinking about a big question, a question that seems unanswerable, but extremely important. If I'm going to bother people, if I'm going to ask for 10 hours of your time, I want to make sure it's worthwhile. So I want to write about something that seems persistently important to me. And climate change obviously is persistently important. It's the big question of our century.
But you said that this novel couldn't be set in Arizona. Is Appalachia an area that's been greatly affected by climate change already?
Well, yes, it is. It's a region of farmers, and farmers on our continent are the people who are first to lose their livelihoods, first to be sort of feel the impingement of unpredictable weather. So I live in a region where I'm watching this happen already. And it also happens that this region of rural conservative farmers is the place where climate change is least discussed. These people who are already feeling it and suffering from it are among this country's least prepared to understand or really even believe in climate change. That's a conundrum. That's a novel. That's the question I wanted to write about. Why is it that we can all look at the same set of evidence and come away believing different things?
Is it because of political inclination, or do you think it's because they've just grown up in a certain tradition and there are good years and bad years and they assume that this is more the same?
Well, yes and yes. It's both those things and a lot of other things. It's a whole novel's worth of things. This question of why we can't talk about it is extremely important.
You studied biology both as an undergraduate and graduate student.
That's right.
So did writing this book involve more of your academic training than your previous novels?
It did involve more science than average, although I often write about science. But this novel specifically has scientists as characters, and the novel explores the methods of science and really what science does and does not do for us. Among other things, it's about science versus faith.
Now, your central character has a very non-science, more artistic name, Della Robbia Turnbow. She's a stay-at-home mother of two who lives on a sheep farm owned by her in-laws. Obviously, the name did not come out of a real love of Italian Renaissance art.
No, in fact, it's news to her when someone in the novel tells her, "Oh, that was a painter," and she's so shocked. She says, "I can't believe I never Googled my own name," because she was named sort of accidentally by her mother, who had read about something called a Della Robbia wreath in a like a garden magazine. She's a very confined character. She grew up in this very small town. If she ever had big dreams, they were put aside when she became pregnant
at 17
and married her sweet but kind of dumb husband, and she's been locked in ever since. She spent every day of her life in a little house on her in-laws farm taking care of kids. She's never been anywhere. She has no flight plan until something very shocking happens on her family's land.
Well, she's feeling trapped in life and in that marriage. And is this something that might have happened to the girls you knew growing up?
The people of this novel are very familiar to me.
These are some of the people you went to high school with?
They're the people among whom I live. Not specifically. I never base characters on real people. That wouldn't really work for me because I construct my fiction in a different way. I figure out first what people need to do, and then I invent the people to do it. So these aren't specifically people I know, but they're very much of the culture that I call mine. These are my people.
A listener, James from Brooklyn, has written in. I guess he is someone who wants to write, and he has one of those questions. Maybe you can give him some advice. Oh. He says, how many, if any, books and short stories have you stopped working on because the story didn't work?
Oh, plenty. But I think... maybe not the majority, because I tend to figure out where a story is going first before I write it. I do the architecture first. I figure out what the story is about, and then I just keep working at it till I get there.
You know the beginning and the end. How much of the middle do you know?
It's sort of like a GPS. If you know where you're starting and where you're going to end up, there are many routes.
Well, Carmina has taken me on some false
recalculating. That's it. You have to recalculate sometimes. Sometimes you have to make the first available U-turn. And the good thing is that your readers will never know how hard you worked to get from here to there. But it does, I think, help to know where I'm going.
My guest is Barbara Kingsolver. Her latest novel, Flight Behavior, is published by Harper. You include vivid descriptions of sheep shearing and cleaning and dyeing the shorn fleeces. Did these come from your own experiences?
As a matter of fact, yes. Glad you asked that question. I live on a sheep farm. I do have a day job, but we also raise sheep. I really like the work, and so for years I've had these details, this kind of knowledge in my life: shearing, vaccinating, even delivering. I've delivered a breech lamb. That's something exciting I can put on my resume. I never really thought this information would find its way into a novel, but when I began working out the structure of this novel and realized I wanted to tell the story from the point of view of farm people, why not a sheep farm?
You make it clear that farming and sheep raising are not lucrative occupations. In fact, you write that a farmer's income can be greatly affected by the weather on sheep shearing day.
That's right.
But you also say that it's not your day job. So are many farmers working at other jobs as well?
Yes. Most farmers I know have at least one member of the family has an off-farm job. Where I live, that's almost necessary. And the sad thing is, a lot of the farmers I know in my region live on the same land their parents and their grandparents worked. Those grandparents did not need an off-farm job. So farming is becoming substantially less lucrative every generation, and more difficult as the weather becomes more unpredictable.
And Della Robbia's husband drives a gravel truck.
Right.
Now, is there a sheep shearing day, a specific one? Can't people just wait for dry weather to do the sheep shearing?
No. Sheep shearing itself is a dying art. It's very hard work. There is a shearer, well, I can tell you in real life, We have one shearer who works our region, and he goes from farm to farm, and you book him way in advance. And he's one of the in the novel. She says he's more valued in this region than any drug dealer or man of the cloth. His skills are irreplaceable. And the truth. And also in the novel, she sort of ruefully acknowledges that her now husband had to change their wedding date. It was a shotgun marriage, of course, but they had to change their wedding date because her mother-in-law said, nope, that's the day the sheep shearer is coming. So when the shearer is coming, you have to shear. And it's really hard physical work. Not a lot of people want to do that.
And also you say it's really skilled. I've watched it on film, and it looks almost magical the way they can cut off the wool just up to the skin without ever breaking the skin.
Right, and it comes, well, ideally, never, right? You don't nick the sheep, and it all comes off in one piece. It's a very, it's an amazing and beautiful kind of dance to watch. And this young woman who, you've already alluded to the fact that she kind of has a wandering eye. Well, she's very confined in her life, and she, up until the opening of the novel, has kind of survived her stultifying life by entertaining various fantasies. And on shearing day, she's saying the way he works that blade makes a woman think certain thoughts. He's very artful.
And the book begins with Della Robbia walking in the woods to meet this man who's not her husband.
Headed for a tryst. And this is, I mean, clear. It's clear in the beginning that she is about to wreck her life. In fact, that's...
You say that.
That's the opening sentence. Yes, there, a certain feeling comes with throwing your good life away, and it is one part rapture.
But she is stopped by coming across this startling sight, a valley that seems to be on fire,
right,
yet is not.
Right. She's halfway up the mountain, her heart pounding. She's never done this before, even though she's contemplated for years. So she's about to meet this man who is not her husband, throw everything away, and she is stopped by the sight, looking out across the valley of this wooded mountainside in southern Appalachia. She sees what looks like fire. All the trees are sort of glittering and glowing orange, and when the light changes, they sort of shimmer, and she thinks this is the this is a burning bush on steroids. She doesn't know what to make of it. She has nothing in her life has prepared her for a sight like this, and so she decides it was a sign from God or from someone. It's a miracle. And so she turns around, marches down that hill, determined to make her life over, to sort of make good on life. But also, she can't tell anybody what she's seen. And this becomes problematic.
Mm. Well, it's what she's seen is a population of monarch butterflies. The butterflies that we normally would have seen in Mexico, are they now going to Tennessee?
Well, in not an actual fact, but in this novel, well, okay, let's sort out fact from fiction here. In actual fact, the whole eastern population of monarch butterflies, many millions of butterflies, all converge in one place for the winter. They migrate from as far north as Ontario all the way to mountains in central Mexico, and in fact, just a few mountaintops. So if you can imagine the sight of 15 million butterflies in one forested mountainside.
In Michoacán,
that's right. It does look like fire, especially if you didn't have your glasses on because you were going to meet someone and you had a little vanity going. So that was the starting point of this novel for me. I woke up one morning with that vision in my eyes, thinking of all those butterflies displaced. What if instead of going to Mexico one year, they landed on a forested mountain in Appalachia?
But
and I knew then I had a novel.
But in your novel, A Tennessee Mountainside, where the butterflies have settled, has been earmarked for logging. So those butterflies in the future would have a hard time using this place again.
Not only that, it's problematic for dozens of reasons. One of them is that this mountainside has severe winters. But even backing up from that point, if this happened, which it has not happened, but this is the literary device of this novel, if that happened, it would have happened because climate change had shifted so many things about the continent-wide ecosystem of this species that they are gravely misinformed by environmental cues. It's a sign of a pervasive sickness in the system. Now, I did invent this event for the butterflies, but in actual fact, I thought that it would be a good way to write about climate change because this has happened already for a lot of species. Many other species are experiencing this kind of disruption.
And in your novel, the flooding in Michoacán is caused by logging and clear cutting. And I understand that there is a shrinking environment for monarch butterflies in Mexico. So De La Robbia, we don't want to reveal the whole plot, but she has to find a way to let people know that these butterflies are there without saying, I was on my way to have an illicit affair.
Right. It kind of slips out. And then once it's discovered, it goes viral because this becomes, of course, extremely interesting to the media, to biologists, to tourism, to all sorts of opportunists and environmentalists as well, all come into this little town with each with his own agenda. And that's where the conversation happens. Getting back to what I really wanted to write about, this event forces a conversation between people who cannot talk about climate change. It's about these different divides between rural and urban, between science and faith.
Because a megachurch dominates this community.
Well, yeah, but it's an interesting megachurch. It's Pastor Bobby Ogle is not a villain by any means. He's a character that I really enjoyed a lot. And the faith community is a really important part of this novel and one of the ways that people absorb their truths.
De La Robbia calls them Team Camo and Team Latte.
The divisions, yeah. When she's trying to explain to this outsider, this biologist, Dr. Ovid Byron, who just doesn't understand why people in her community won't believe what the scientists are telling them. And she says, well, you don't really get to choose your beliefs. You grow up on your team and the beliefs get handed out. And she says there's Team Camo and there's Team Latte.
There's also a big difference in the way they live their lives. When an environmentalist tells De La Robbia she should bring Tupperware to restaurants for leftovers, she says she hasn't eaten in a restaurant for 2 years.
Right. This novel, among other things, is about class, and it's about environmentalism and class. There are things in this novel that, as far as I can see, have not been well addressed in our country, and I think that it's really time we did.
You have been the recipient of many literary prizes. You've also established one of your own, haven't you?
I have.
The Bellwether Prize for Fiction.
That's right, which is now the Penn Bellwether Prize. Penn is my partner in administering this prize, but specifically it is a prize for an unpublished first novel, so it's meant to be a career-founding event, and it is a prize that rewards what we call socially engaged literature, good fiction that addresses matters of this world.
You feel that there wasn't enough recognition of that in the literary world? It's hard for writers of that sort to get published.
In the United States, it is. Elsewhere in the world, I think that people really do look to their artists as social critics. In this country, not so much. So I think there's room to emphasize and give that kind of literature more cachet here.
Barbara Kingsolver has been translated into more than 20 languages, and in 2000 she was awarded the National Humanities Medal, our country's highest honor for service through the arts. She's received a number of other prizes, as I said, and how many novels altogether?
Well, this is my 14th book, and I guess number 8 in, I think I'd have to count, maybe 7th or 8th novel.
And I'm so pleased that it brought you back to our show.
I am too.
Flight Behavior is published by Harper.